Thanks very much. My name's Thomas, I'm an addict.
Hi, Thomas.
I was a bit nervous this morning and I texted Mickey. Thank you, Mickey, for asking me to do this. I texted Mickey and I said, Mickey, I'm a bit nervous about how to put this together in 15 minutes. I don't know how to do it. And he texted back, 15, question mark, you're doing the 40. And I felt a surge of adrenaline like I haven't felt in quite a long time, which was pure fear. It was like, I'm so glad I'm not sitting where you're sitting. I just couldn't do it. I was. So thanks, Mickey, for that. My name's Thomas. I grew up in London, North London, in an alcoholic home. My dad was an alcoholic. Very early on, I decided I was adopted, that I was actually Scottish. I started to wear a kilt to school, to primary school, and I changed my name to Tom Scott. Which didn't go down very well in the Tottenham part of London. But I knew that I wasn't part of my family and that the life that I had wasn't the life that I was meant to have. So my dad left. My neighbour's dad died of a heart attack from cocaine around the same time. And the four of us formed a gang. And my first sort of thrill chasing was stealing and setting things on fire. And we used to nick things from cars and just run around being kind of uncontrolled. And that definitely was the beginning of, I suppose, the addictive behaviour started to kick in quite early there with cigarettes. A tenant moved into our house and he had weed hanging from the balcony, and I started to get very fascinated by that, and I started to not sell it, but I was definitely purveying it and handling it and getting interested in it while I was still at primary school. And that was the beginning of a 29-year journey handling, selling and taking drugs. It progressed. Alcohol kicked off when I was 15. Because of my dad's alcoholism, I saw it as a sort of family business, and you know, the ability to take a lot of alcohol and to be the last man standing became a kind of a signature behaviour, which also stayed with me until my sober day. Definitely full-time dealing by the time I was 18. And that's what got me through college, paid my way through college by dealing. And on the last day of college, we'd been up all night preparing our work, and a friend came to me and he had a marijuana spliff with speed in it. And I remember smoking it, lying on the floor and thinking, that's it, that's the high. And I chased that high relentlessly for the rest of my drug-taking career. It was being pushed and pulled by an upper and a downer at the same time, and it didn't matter what was doing that. It was the fact that I was being pulled in two different directions, and I didn't have to be sitting with the feelings of inadequacy about who I was. That continued. I got a job which allowed that behaviour, in fact condoned it. I work in an industry that actually positively encourages drug taking in some ways. And so it all just stepped up. Every single step of the career path also included taking more and more drugs. And I lost a marriage. I got married when I was quite young, and my wife left me. She made the ultimatum, you know, it's either me or your drugs. And I asked her to close the door on the way out, which I thought was an amazingly clever thing to say at the time. But that's the way I dealt with emotions. That's the way I dealt with love. A string of unsuccessful relationships that ended pretty much in the same way. I wasn't prepared to make any compromises or sacrifices around my drug taking, and it continued. It just kind of I never ever thought that I would have to stop. I think partly because of the way I was brought up and the environment I was brought up in by alcoholics and, you know, alcoholics' friends, it just seemed to me that that was who I was. And I carried on the tradition, and I felt, you know, the apples had not fallen far from the tree. I started to work with someone in my industry who was doing really well, and his success, I sort of, you know, was coattailing it to a certain extent, but there was a lot of partying. I was the go-to guy for drugs, and that became my reputation, you know, along with Thomas's promises, which was a sort of catchy phrase for things that I would say that would then not happen. not proud of that one, but anyway. My dad then died of alcohol, encephalopathy, happy to get that word out of the way. He got wet brain and died, and then we got a call to go to Hollywood, and we went off to Hollywood and made a film, and I decided to stay and work within a community in LA called Skid Row, which is a homeless community downtown Los Angeles, and I started to work in that community. I stayed there for 18 months. I worked on this project, and I was, by night, I was a, you know, drug-taking lunatic, drinking very heavily and drugging, but I had this anchor, which was this project. And the odd thing that happened, or the unique thing that happened, was that I kept running into these people that were in recovery, and they just, they could smell it on me. They just knew what I was up to. And I was doing an interview with Clancy I, who at that point was 55 years sober, was one of Bill's sponsees. And we stopped the interview, and he looked at me, and I was sweating cocaine and vodka. And I was, it's like LA August, you know what I mean? Everyone has got a tan except for Thomas. And he looked at me and he went, "Thomas, is there something you want to tell me?" The guy's had 2,000 sponsees, and he was like, and I said, "No, I'm fine." It went on. I had an amazing experience making this film, but I was falling apart inside. I hadn't grieved for my dad. I was in a mess. And then in April 2009, the guy that I was working with, and I'd worked with him every day for 18 months on this project, was murdered by a gang member. It was a 7-shot complete, and I fell apart. It was brutal, and I didn't have any program. I had no way of processing what was going on, and I ended up on Skid Row not making a film. And I was in blackout for a lot of that period. I was definitely, you know, there are little moments I remember. I remember coming around in a room with a gang member called Happy. And I said, "Why do they call you Happy?" And he pulled out a big bag of crack and an Uzi. And he said, "That's why they call me Happy." Thank you. I knew there was something really, really wrong, because I couldn't feel anything. And the only strategy I had for living was to take drugs. I never went to bed sober. I don't remember huge patches of time, and I was feeling very broken. And I came back to London, and I think just that thing that happens sometimes, where a seed of a thought, you know, the first little seed of a thought is put there by someone in recovery who just says a few key things, and that seed of that thought was to ask for help. I was never going to do that before, and I finally rang someone and said, I can't sleep, I'm having panic attacks, the drugs aren't working, I've come out of this incredibly intense experience and I need help. And so I went to a meeting and I heard people identify what I'd experienced my entire life. Feelings of more than, less than, I identified with that straight away. Feeling fixing, constantly fixing my feelings, trying to stay in a place in the middle. That had been the art form of my life. I'd put a lot of energy into that, not ever knowing what it was called, you know. And slowly but surely, I put together, the program I have today. I got a sponsor, I did the steps. I sulked in meetings for a long time. I didn't really want to speak. I wasn't very vocal in meetings. I found it very difficult to share. I didn't want to be judged. And I was very scared. But, you know, slowly but surely, I've found my way in this fellowship, and I have commitments. I'm a GSR. I have a district commitment, HNIPI, and I have three sponsees, and that's really only happened for me in the last year. Is sponsorship has made my recovery so much bigger and so much about other people. It's not about me as much as it's about them. I don't want to mess up as a sponsor. There's pride in that, but there's also, I've done my first pass through the 12 steps. I'm now going through it again with another sponsor. And the road is getting narrow. You know, I'm feeling more at home in these rooms than I ever did in any drug den. I'm finding ways to articulate what it feels like to be me. And I never thought that was going to be possible, and I never thought I would be able to be honest on any level, really. Honesty was not really something I was very familiar with. So slowly but surely, one day at a time, I'm becoming more and more grateful for this program in a really genuine way. It's given me my life back, and not necessarily the life I asked for initially or what I would have wanted initially. I came in here and all I wanted was to get sober. But what it's given me is, it's just beginning to happen, I suppose, but the ability to speak from the heart and to be able to tell people the truth even when the chips are down or when things aren't going my way. I'm a very happy customer, and I'm very grateful to be asked to do this. I've got a little sort of puff of pride when Mickey asked me, and apart from the nerves this morning, thank you very much for letting me share.